Welcome to the Great Bays Tennis Podcast, episode 137. I'm Steve Smith, along with friend, old friend, 15 years, Andres Barbosa, the fact checker.
Well, nice to be back, Steve, and it's nice to see you back on the old podcast.
Yeah, no, I appreciate mentioning
Yvonne
that.
Yvonne did a great job the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I haven't been on the podcast. Thanks, Yvonne, for sure. Hard worker, smart guy. I do want to say thank everybody for all their text messages and calls and emails. And certainly I was not in a position to take calls, 10 days in the hospital. But I want to just go back to the podcast with Steve Campbell, the director of tennis at the Wintergreen Resort. And just based on my health, I'm not going to be there for the summer. And that's why I certainly, let people know via Instagram and Facebook that, I was a little out of commission for a while, but knock on wood, I'm in better shape and just going to take some time and regroup. And beautiful, beautiful sunny Florida. I think I need to, do some work in tennis education and find myself on indoor courts. What I did find out when I went to the hospital, that is, I'm 68. I'm not 28. So, hey, we have many things we could talk about. Let's do this first. Basketball. I'm telling tennis players all the time, become very good at a second sport. But let's do this. Miami, Andres is from Miami. His brother JD with the University of Miami. Why don't you give us a mascot story from JD?
Well, first off, I think we talked about this before. He doesn't like his secret identity being revealed. So
he's retired now, though. He teaches mascots, correct?
I don't know if he still is an honorary one, but... trying to think, the previous podcast we talked about the Butch Davis one.
I didn't know we had that on podcast. I have total recall. I call it recall totally what I want to.
I'm gonna have to think about that one. Give me a few minutes.
Yeah, we'll come back to it.
I'll think of a good one.
I just think of the one because your brother, he wrestled a little bit in high school, and
well, that was the famous one at the Sugar Bowl. That's the one that it was UF versus UM 2000. Miami won the game. That was earlier in the game.
And the Gator mascot came up and pushed him.
The Hurricane fans must have had like 5,000 fans in the Superdome. So the Gator kept walking over. JD would tell him to go back on his side. And then, basically it was pretty funny. The guy got taken down. But later in the game, no one remembers that because later in the game, my brother got the infamous 15-yard penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct for running onto the field. Butch Davis is screaming at him from the sideline saying, get off the field. An extra point became a 35-yard extra point.
Yeah.
Then there was a holding call, and then an extra point became a 50-yard kick. And my poor brother, the rest of the weekend, was not able to enjoy himself in New Orleans, worried about it getting fired. And then basically he had a great story. 5 days later, met up with Butch Davis and the guy apologized, asked him to sign an autographed picture. So, but I will think of a better story.
That's a great one. But here's a visual. At the Sugar Bowl, for the listeners, the mascot of the Hurricanes is a duck.
It is an ibis.
Corrected. It looks like a duck.
It looks like a flamingo. Looks like a lot of things, but he will tell you it is an ibis.
Okay, so the ibis, who has web feet and all white. And
Sebastian.
Okay.
Sebastian the Ibis.
So anyway, the UF team, the Gators dressed like a gator. And that, was it 100,000 people in the stadium? So your brother wrestles him down and he takes his web, his foot, and puts it on and he's up like this and the crowd goes crazy.
Well, the 5,000 fans went crazy. I don't think I don't think the Gator fans were too happy at that. But that was my first recollection of text messages. Because I had a Nokia back then, and then it just blew up. All my friends texted me, is that your brother? It was when the infamous penalty happened.
Fans, the basketball tournament, so everybody's talking basketball. Women's basketball is absolutely unbelievable. When I was at this college in Texas for 10 years, I used to have to, throughout the 80s, 81, 89, actually. But I walked from my office and I went across to the gym to get my mail. And I know nothing about basketball, but during the time I was there, women's basketball improved so much. And now it's like, whew. Here's something for tennis players to look up is, how did Nancy Lieberman help Martina Navratilova? Y'all, going back to your brother, is that, I mean, I looked for that right away on YouTube, but I couldn't find it. But you could find, I'm sure there's a 60 Minutes or a 2020. There's all sorts of stories on how Martina Navratilova, who grew up in Czechoslovakia, and ski and skate and whatever, but really basketball was not a sport that she did so much as a kid. But it's just great for agility, great for footwork.
I mean, Nancy Lieberman is still commentating. I think, unless she's retired now, but up until recently, I was hearing her in NBA games, and she was doing all types of basketball games.
Side note on that, I was with Austin Krajicek at a tournament in Knoxville, Tennessee, and we stayed with a really nice family. And I knew at that time Pat Summitt, the late Pat Summitt, the coach of Tennessee basketball. Her health wasn't very good. So I said, hey, do you know Pat Summitt? And I go, do we know Pat Summitt? And the next day, I went to this function and I sat at the table with the head coach. She's a commentator now, but that was a very fun experience. So then after the dinner, we stayed at this facility where the function was hosted, a country club. And, you know, we stayed there way past midnight, just talking, you know, character of an athlete. That comes to my mind. Another basketball, I mentioned this many times, Tommy Haas. Every time I used to be at Nick Baltieri's, we just wanted to watch Tommy Haas play basketball.
I mean, there may be some Boca residents out here that want you to mention Florida Atlantic also being in the Final Four.
Yeah, with Florida Atlantic, you got to go for the underdog. I remember when Florida Gulf Coast was in.
Yep.
And the guys on the team did it. I actually was at the game. It's the only time I've ever been to a game. I was in Texas, and I went to the facility where the Cowboys play, and tickets were purchased for us last minute, and I was up high. I mean, I just looked at the TV. I guess it's the biggest TV in the world. But these guys from Gulf Coast, they all were in different shoes. And the entire budget, you know, the coach and the travel expenses, recruiting expenses, jerseys, whatever, from the shoes – that total budget was less than, I think it might have been Patino, but it was one of the really named coaches. That coach made more money per year than that, the budget of that entire team.
Oh, I'm sure. There's some coaches out there that are.
The FAU Owls, there's a joke about the owl who had laryngitis and was constipated. We're not supposed to swear on the podcast, but he couldn't hoot with a hoot.
Andy's going to be bleeping this later.
Yeah, no, Yvonne will take care of that. Seriously, we need to keep it clean. The SHIT, just so you know, I saw this by David Squire. Funny, funny Australian. SHIT comes from store high in transit. When they would put fertilizer on a ship, it's combustible, so they wouldn't put it at the bottom of the ship. They put it up top. With Marty Reason. Played basketball at Northwestern. There's many stories like this. And he became top 10 in the world. I think he was 38 when he was top 10 in the world. But what an athlete that guy was. I think when I say basketball, it's not go out. We get junior tennis player playing basketball. It's just hard to look at. And they start arguing about the score. But get a basketball, dribble left-handed, right-handed, in and out of the cones, backwards, forwards. That's, you know, YouTube's good for many, many things. But basketball skills.
I would be doing a disservice to my birth state if I don't mention that John Lucas was a phenomenal
Maryland, right?
Terrapins, yeah. Was the number one pick in the draft, and I never saw him play tennis, but I know he was an All-American at Maryland for tennis. So, any stories on John Lucas?
Well, I remember when he played team tennis. You know, I know he ended up having a tough time with cocaine and drugs and such, and he bounced back. And, you know, he did a lot for educating the youth on not being involved with drugs. And he came back and had a very outstanding coaching career.
Did he have a coaching career also in tennis with like Zena Garrison and Lloyd?
He did. Very good. Yeah. I remember watching those two girls play. the Texas Heat, and they didn't use a grip like in the old days. They just played with
leather. Yeah,
no grip at all. They just played with the wood, the wooden handle. With let's do this with tennis on TV. I think we can talk about the Indian Wells singles champions, but tell us about the game you got. I think college kids would love this. You know,
this has really gotten from we're treacherous towards a PG-13 rating down here. Now, I think it'd be a great drinking game to go out there every time you hear the commentators during the Miami Open refer to margin, shape.
So you hear the word shape and you take a shot
all the time. I mean, literally, you would think that nothing else is happening. I mean, that's why I'm a big Jim Courier fan. I love listening to Courier because he's the only one that actually goes out there and gives you consistent analysis, in my opinion, where everybody else, it's regurgitated keywords, basically.
I like Gilbert. If I had to pick one, I just like Gilbert.
But he doesn't do the Tennis Channel.
Yeah, no.
He does ESPN for...
I learned a lot of inside stories on Jim Courier over the years. I actually had a friend take John Nienagel's book, and you know, he was down as a ENFJ and just to see what the mother thought. We did some things where we used to donate time to his charity in Tampa, where we would do a ladies clinic like once a year, and the ladies would pay so much, and there'd be 12 of them, and all the money went to his foundation. But I worked with his sister, Audrey, or I did some coaching with his niece and his nephew's nephew, great kid. Became very good, played at Jesuit High School. The niece, I think she played at Oregon, but she had played all these sports and had a late start. But my recollection is that she was a lefty and so fast and such an athlete. But so you take a shot in this drinking game. It could be a sip of beer. I mean, it'll be
stumbling if you during the Miami Open. You won't last very long.
I mean, yeah, certainly. I mean, how about a sip of beer, a 12-ounce curl?
What I found interesting yesterday was listening to Wozniacki, where she didn't know anything about her racket that she used in her career. Didn't know that it was 100 square inches. Didn't know it was 16 by 19. I thought Brett Haybert did her an injustice out there, sticking her out there to look a little foolish. But
I was in Denmark.
They had to give her the notes mid-match.
I was in Denmark, 14, Tennis Europe tournament, and beautiful, beautiful place. And they asked me, you know, this a coach of the federation, you know, he was told by another federation coach to talk to me. So they asked me to work with this girl serve. She needed a lot of work on her serve, but she was like 11 playing in this tournament. But she was like a little Wozniacki. I mean, just can run and run. I mean, there's a backboard story. There's a player who's from the backboard. But let me say this about take a shot. The drinking game.
Your hockey background is really coming out.
No, this is better. So Wayne Gretzky, how's it go? You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. That's a Wayne Gretzky quote. But you're an old friend, but during this hiatus, being home from the hospital, I visited an old friend, Rocky Balboa. And it really was because there was this young junior here, very young, 12, but when he was like 9, his father and his sister come to pick him up after a practice, and Rocky comes up, and both the brother and the sister start quoting Rocky. So I hadn't seen him a long time because of the pandemic, but he was down here visiting. And so he mentioned Rocky. And I was on the couch, and I said, well, we should start watching Rocky. I just asked the dad, hey, it'd be okay if I take your kid to see Creed 3, which is coming out. And I said, oh, we can do better than that. So we watched I think it would have been 5 days, but the last I was dropped off, and Yvonne dropped us off, and I just had some cash. I didn't have a wallet, a phone, or a credit card. And we were dropped off a place where you could only get in by paying with a credit card. So we spent 2 hours. I said, oh, we just got to find something to do for 2 hours, and we walked the beach and whatever. But anyway, with Rocky Balboa, And some of this, being a fact checker, I heard 3,000. I've read 3,000. I read 18,000. So Rocky's just down and out. I believe it was he got 160,000, but he held out where he had to be the main character. And he has his, you know, big dog, the dog in Rocky One, Buck. That's his dog in real life. But a big dog like that.
What was the name of the dog?
Buckus, the football player. So he couldn't feed the dog. So in front of a 7-Eleven, also I've read where it's from a grocery store, but same thing, is he stood in front of the 7-Eleven to sell the dog, and he sold the dog. And I think it was he sold the dog for $100. And what a tough thing to do. I mean, I remember being with a friend of mine. He had gone through a divorce and they had no children. But we went out to dinner, and side story, come back to Rocky. So he's just down and out. He's getting divorced. But why he was divorced is his ex was getting the dog. And the dog was his before they got married. But coming back to Rocky, so Rocky gets the 160 grand. He waits in front of the store for 3 days. And he knew the guy would eventually come back, whether he's buying gas or groceries or whatever. So he comes back and they negotiate. And that's where, you know, the most recent number is $18,000. But so he buys the dog back, but the guy also negotiates that he hasn't had a scene in the movie. And I don't think this is true because I've looked it up. But I was told that the bartender was the guy who bought the dog and didn't want to sell the dog back. And he got some more money, and can you imagine the $18,000? But he wanted a spot in the movie, and there's a bartender.
And, early, right? In the first one.
Yeah, in Rocky One. Right. And, you know, he has a part in Rocky Two as well, but because they show the people in the bar, you know, jumping up and down. And so it's on the screen that Apollo Creed is going to give an unknown a shot. And, you know, the bartender goes, Apollo Creed is a bum. And Rocky goes, what do you mean a bum? He's the best. And he goes, imagine being able to take a shot against the best of the best, the greatest fighter of all time. And then Rocky, he had taken one sip out of his beer, he throws a couple bucks on the bar and walks out in disgust. So it's just the bartender. And Rocky's walking out the bar, and the bartender lifts a shot glass and a bottle of booze. He goes, you want me to take a shot? I'll take a shot. And he pours the booze in the shot glass and takes a shot. But so let's go through the Indian Wells champions. We can talk tennis. It'd be good.
Tennis, a little boxing.
Touch about tennis. We've gone to basketball, to the mascot.
We'll go Mike Tyson. His daughter plays tennis.
Yes, they're down at Battle of Boca. I remember Mike Tyson, I think years gone by, Joe McMahon is a tough guy. He says, yeah, I got to give that guy a piece of my mind. I used to always say, don't give him a very big piece, Joe. But Joe was always like, I'm going to, you know, he's upset with someone. And he used to sound like a boxer. But he was in New York City, and he was in an elevator, and Mike Tyson comes in and just goes right up to him, nose to nose, and just stared at him. And McMahon was like, whoa. You know, that's the kind of stuff you can't make up. And the elevator door opens, and the boxer walks out, and McMahon's going, whoa, I'm happy to be alive. But I think let's talk about the player I'll go with the first name. You go with the second name. Elena.
Rybakina.
Rybakina. What are your thoughts?
You know, it's funny because I've been watching her for a few years because she reminds me of a girl that I coached a lot in high school. Now she's finishing up in college. We're basically, you know, big, tall girl, athletic, you know, hits the ball pretty clean. But it's just amazing how composed she is. You know, she wins the event, and not even,
oh yeah, the Wimbledon triumph.
You know, that's twice. I mean, that, you know, wins Indian Wells and wins Wimbledon, and barely a smile, which is kind of incredible when you think about it. But
you know, the first point I want to make, you know, we call our curriculum, our nonprofit, Great Base Tennis, and it really comes from Richard Hernandez. Tennis needs a Great Base Initiative. It still needs a Great Base Initiative. And we're talking about entry-level juniors, entry-level adults. You know, people just don't get a good start. Vic Braden, there's no substitute for a good beginning. But it could be solid fundamentals, but that girl is so good technically. It's just like a clinic.
She had a bunch of, before that Wimbledon win, she had a bunch of like quarters, semis. I'd been waiting for her to break through for about, I don't know, a year, maybe six slams before that. But
coming back to women's basketball, some of those players are 6'3". She's 6'1". I did take some notes. You know, she started as a gymnast and an ice skater. And like Novotna, I always think of these two young guys from Miami I coached. Their father was 6'8". And you would know the last
Zeters.
Name. Zeters. And they when they were little kids, they weren't taught to go forward. But Novotna, her mother used to always take her to her gymnastic training session. And then one day the father did, and the father was really tall, and they called her in and said, "You're going to be too big for the sport." And the same thing happened with Elena
Rybakina.
She was, she was just told too big for gymnastics. And she was in a group of eight and trained the entire time to the age of 15. Didn't have a private lesson until she was 15. She went to regular school, and her tennis was in the afternoon. It was 2 hours of tennis and 3 hours of fitness, because she just needed the fitness work, the balance work. I mean, people need to hear that. She started playing ITF. At age 14, she played the grade twos and threes. I think a lot of parents aren't familiar enough with the different levels. It's the grade ones that are the best players. She started playing that when she was 15. Do you remember Andrei Chesnikov?
I do.
I remember watching him. I believe he lost in the Orange Bowl. Courier, fact checker. But I have to look that up. I was at the match when Courier won the Orange Bowl.
I played the men's nationals a couple of years ago, and Cherkasov was playing. Andrei Cherkasov was playing. And
I remember I was working a great deal with Jim Lehrer, and you know, he was just talking about Courier being so tough. The first director of player development for the UCA was Ron Woods. And he used to say, well, you build a brick wall and you put a wheelbarrow of money on the other side of the brick wall. And what Pete Sampras would do is, you know, take a couple steps back, look at it and go, okay, we're going to find a way to go over that wall. He said to Jim Courier, he didn't even look at it. He just was going to go right through the wall. Coming back to his sister, Audra, the first time he lost a match, he cried for 3 days. You know,
I'm trying to remember his niece's name, because I do remember her, and she did go to Oregon, and I can't remember her name.
Oh, I'd take a guess at it, but I can just picture her. She, when she was a younger kid, she went to one of these private schools in Tampa, and she had all these friends, and she played every sport, you know, just had a social agenda. But she was, I used to call her Wheels. She was just so fast. Her coach, now a Croatian, this is interesting, is coming back to your, the players on the commentating on TV. I mean, I do love the opportunity to watch all this tennis on TV. I used to say in Tennis Magazine, very expensive ad, I'm going to take out an ad. It's going to say school or clinic camp for TV commentators. And no one would ever come. It'd be kind of fun to have that ad.
I do miss those days. I remember being a kid and waiting for that magazine to arrive in the mail. And
yeah, it was like a small phone book.
Once a month, you were.
No, the economy and a number of things.
The quality dropped significantly, though. Over.
Oh, it used to be you could have two articles in the same magazine about the forehand. The Japanese magazines were the best, where they had the sequence of players. I remember when Paul Anacone was coming towards the end of his career, and he was hanging around in this tennis academy that Robbie Saguzzo and Carlene Bassett owned. And Robbie would listen to Anacone. You know, and Anacone, the first time I met him was at the Miami tournament, and I just popped in with Doug Cash, and there was a school, an ATP school at that time. They brought in teaching professionals, and Anacone was going to that, and his brother being a teaching pro. I met his brother, I think it's Steven. But so I remember going, hey, let's look at this first. And it was a sequence of a serve, and you know, and that's what people really needed, is they needed to see frame by frame. But her coach, Stefan, V-U-K-U-O, how do you give it a shot? Vukov? But he only played at the futures level. That means you're a pretty good player if you're playing at the futures level. You know, the best college players are going to do really well at the futures level, the best college players. But he was 11-22 in the world. You know, obviously with these numbers, I don't know how long he, the war of financial attrition, how long he was able to give it a go. But he earned $10,805. And, you know, I do think that, you know, it's amazing. The TV commentators do have access to the players. It's amazing how many TV commentators are coaching, consulting. Well, and if we're listening to them and all they've got is target and margin, and, yeah, what do they have when they're coaching him?
Well, what's really annoying is when you know who's playing in the match, you know who's playing in the semifinal, and they're speaking in another language, and they don't have somebody prepared to translate from the coach's box, which is, you know, they've made such a big deal about, you know, bringing in coaching, making it accessible to the fans, and bringing in all that involvement, and then there's no one to translate. So, you know, I can see when it happens with Spanish players. I mean, I speak Spanish, so it doesn't bother me, but I can only imagine somebody like yourself that is still aiming to master Spanish.
I speak Spanish. The best word is trabajo, work, right? No, my sister came here to visit.
You said it pretty well. Trabajo.
My sister came here to visit, and I remember signing up for Latin, and they dropped Latin. So I go home, and I say, hey, there's no Latin. Well, my mother talked to some friends. They had to have, I don't think, 12 kids. Next thing you know is I'm in Latin. But I eventually took Spanish, you know, a great line. I had the brains that God gave little green apples. And I remember, I'll never use this. You know, I mean, I can remember getting A's in Spanish, and I always tell people, yeah, I couldn't order lunch. It's taught so poorly. It's not interactive. It's not, you know, they're not teaching language skills.
You got to immerse yourself. You got to fly down there in South America and just.
Well, you have to be careful where you go too. Is that if you were to go to, I remember one time sending a player, I think both Colombia and Peru, but you know, if you go to Costa Rica, if you go to Spain, you know, if you're in Barcelona, you can speak English and get by. We had a German kid. He became number one in, excuse me, a Russian. We had a Russian, and his grandmother used to bring players. His aunt, fact checker. His aunt used to bring players. They're from Sochi and Roman. He used to come over. And so anyway, what happened is he became very good. And it was Kafelnikov, and they created a sponsorship. So a young guy, he was too soon. He's 13 years old, and he goes to Germany with a sponsorship. So when he was with us, you know, he never learned English. But when he went to Germany, he learned English. Yeah, that was not like he went to Germany and learned German. Right. It's interesting when people who speak a number of different languages and they come together, it just takes them a minute. Say there's three or four people. It just takes them a blink of an eye to decide what language they'll communicate best in. You know, but her coach, he's just the opposite from this article I read, his brain type. Elena is so quiet and reserved, controlled. And, you know, one of the things he said, I really know how to get her angry. I really know how to get her intense. But he one time was on TV and he criticized how she played. And the media was very shocked by that. But then the player said, no, I don't have a problem at all. We always tell kids, be positive, be polite when people compliment you, but criticism is your Kool-Aid. You got to be your own best critic. If you can't handle criticism, how's it go? Do nothing, be nothing, say nothing. You just have to thrive on criticism. Let's talk about, I'll go with Carlos. What's his last name?
Alcaraz.
What are your thoughts? I mean, I think the same thing, basics. It's when, you know, can people really see it? It's like we say, can you see the arrow in the FedEx logo? And once you see it, you always can see it. Same thing with, you know, what grip are they using? What's the ready position like? You know, do they have options on their forehand? What comes to your mind?
I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is the speed. Try to remember. I mean, I didn't really get to watch much of Borg other than YouTube clips, but probably the fastest guy I ever saw was Michael Chang. And I remember watching a match with him and McEnroe at the US Open where Mac is coming in and Chang is just running left, right, getting every single ball back. So can't think of a guy that I've seen that was as fast as Alcaraz. It's just incredible. It just seems like he gets.
Yeah, I mean, that's a ditto. But I remember Bobby Marinchak, he played tennis at Georgia, played some on the tour. And, you know, you have this discussion, you know, or let's give us the top 10. But I mean, his thing was Chang. I mean, he just had tree trunks for legs.
It was so low to the ground. He was changing directions, you know. And
I think
maybe it was more pronounced back then because, you know, he was playing against guys like Edberg, who was serving and volleying constantly. And, you know, maybe the matches were a little more interesting. But the guy is just, it's fun to watch. I mean, he's, you know, now the debate is he as complete as these other players? And it's, you know, it seems like a little bit too soon.
The late Eugene Scott played four sports at Yale, working, carrying a briefcase on Wall Street, and he gets to the semis of the U.S. Open. He was greatly respected in many, many ways, wearing different hats throughout the tennis industry, but he had a great line. The fastest tennis players in the world would not win a schoolyard race. So much, I mean, the kid's smiling all the time. I mean, that has a lot to do with speed. He's having fun. And either, you know, the big thing is you can't confirm, reconfirm. You just got to go. And Braden used to do this, that players would go on a statistical cue. And he used to show film that if they were moving before the ball was even hit. I mean, that's where there's just no substitute for playing sets. And that's something that's gone away, where kids are just programmed out because they don't make, you know, the coaches, the clubs, whatever, they don't make money when the kids are playing sets. And then, you know, sometimes it's okay, it's great, it's a controlled set, you know, the boys won't play the girls, the older players won't play the younger players. So there's a lot to be said about the players being assigned matches. That was great about the old days, is that you would play a citywide tournament. They would spread it over 6 or 7 weeks because then everybody could play. And then you'd be on a ladder. And if you wanted to play a better player, you had to defend before you challenged. And people used to call people up. I mean, juniors, the youth versus veteran match, you know, people have said this on the podcast before, that's gone away. Before you drove up from Miami, appreciate you coming up to help us make a comeback. I mean, I think Yvonne was doing A-okay without me, but on this podcast, the people want us to keep it going. And I was looking at some YouTube clips and they were in Spanish. It would have been great to have you here. Where if you want to watch this young kid at age 10, I mean, he was outstanding at age 10.
What's funny, when he, when he won the U.S. Open, I was visiting my parents in Colombia. And earlier in the year, I was also visiting them during the French Open. And personally, I mean, they're kind of friends of mine, but I'm a little bit biased. I feel like the South American coverage of tennis is infinitely better than what you see in the United States. And basically, you know, they go behind the scenes, they interview the player, they interview the coach. So, you know, I mean, you can see it on YouTube, it's out there, but I mean, you get, let's say, Mariano Zabaleta and Juan Monaco interviewing Ferrero when they're coming off the practice court, asking about Alcaraz. This is probably when he was like 17, still when he was, that year that I think he lost to Berrettini at the U.S. Open in 5 sets. Or maybe he beat, I forget already. I have to look back. Now I need to fact check myself.
I remember watching Wimbledon. Actually, in many ways, back in the day, you go to Wimbledon, and it's great, the atmosphere, the strawberries and cream and this and that. And, you know, to be there as a spectator, I mean, it was great in person. Like, for example, to watch Billie Jean King play on grass. You know, the women, I mean, you know, film helps, but if you're right there in person, I mean, from the service line in, Arthur Ashe used to call her the old lady. You know, Navratilova with, you know, her transition, she was awesome at the net. Young junior tennis players, boys and girls should watch Navratilova's service line in.
But let me finish the point here. As far as was Zabaleta, these guys, when he was a young guy, they knew what was coming. Mm. And they interviewed the coach and they asked him, what is he doing training wise? That, you know, and Ferrero would say, we're building up his body. I mean, 19 years old, this guy is built like a brick house. I mean, basically, but it's just amazing the steps taken and the development of his game. You know, you'd probably be a little bit critical of his first serve, saying that there's a little hitch. But I mean, as far as across the board,
oh no, it's just
across
like,
the board. I mean, the guy is very complete, very willing to serve in volley, very willing to play all over the court, and he does play like with a certain charisma that you haven't seen in ages. I mean, hopefully, an agent doesn't get a hold of him and tell him to button it down, because you know you see during the Miami Open, he's there. He's shaking hands with Jimmy Butler during the matches. I mean, he's there. You know, he's great for the sport. He's great for getting kids to think of tennis being cool, as opposed to, you know, all these players going off and giving rehearsed answers. And
yeah, he has so much respect. With coming back to my tangent, BBC, and watching tennis in England, there was no commercials. So I think, in all fairness, the person who's doing the color and the play-by-play while the match is in progress, that's very difficult to, as we hear all these sound bites. But with the tennis channel, for sure, NBC, whatever, there's definitely time with the players, or I should say the commentators. They've got the mic. They've got the floor. I tried to verify if this was true, but trained a coach from Italy not too long ago, and you know, he was looking it up. You know, but I was. As I was told, I read that the Italian coverage at one time was two guys, and the match was being played, and sometimes they could be talking about a restaurant, they'd be talking about, you know, a soccer team, they're just carrying on a conversation. I've mentioned this quite often with Tennis on TV. Brian Wilson, who played for Craig Tiley and was sent to me, he had to take some time off from school, then go back, and he called me up years and years ago and told me that, why don't you guys just do this? Is the match is playing and you do the same thing. You just talk while the match is being played. I think that would be better than just beating up on the commentators. But Carlos versus Elena, 1-6-1 and 1-6-0. Yeah, so he's not a huge guy. Yeah, what you said about the serve is true. But at the same time, with both of them, I mean, you'd have to be so, so picky from a technical standpoint. And there's no perfection.
Which you are.
There's no perfection. But if you study under Braden, for example, the economy motion, least amount of moving parts, least amount of muscle recruitment. But people have to understand Milan. Then it becomes a very tricky ordeal. You say, okay, we'll just tweak this. We'll just change that. And if a guy has been serving that way that long and it's only a little slightly off, it's not off. So his father was a director of a tennis academy where he grew up. And Juan Carlos Ferrero, he started coaching him at 15. When he was 15, I think it was the Davis Cup, but he was offered a big job with the Federation. And he said, thank you, but no thank you. Right now I'm coaching this kid, and it's the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yeah, and it's amazing how he had that foresight to be able to know that.
17, just recently, he was the youngest player in the Australian Open. He's 18. He got a wild card to Madrid, and he won it. So, you know, Nadal was asked about his future, and he said, hey, his future's now. He's already arrived.
But he won Madrid as a 19-year-old, though.
Well, fact checker, that's why you're here.
Goodbye. He might have been like, no, he's going to be 20 now coming up, so.
You can't always believe what you read. He definitely is what you would define correct as an all-court player.
Oh, he's so much fun to watch. I mean, it's just interesting to watch him, all the different options that he has at his disposal. You'll see him against Medvedev in the final. You know, Medvedev was going to be insistent about staying back and return his way, and then Alcaraz was just systematically picking and choosing his moments to serve in volley. I thought he did a great job. And the match, the one that's going to be interesting, though, is the matchup with him and Sinner, I think, in the next 3 to 5 years. It's going to be a very interesting matchup. I think those two already seem to have a pretty good rivalry going up. And then personally, I'm kind of interested to see how Alcaraz does tomorrow against Tommy Paul. So it's interesting watching the coaching team. I know Brad Stein, you were mentioning Courier. I mean, 30 years ago, he was coaching Courier. And here he is 30 years later with Tommy Paul. And then I saw another buddy of mine that I guess works a little bit with him, Hugh Armando. I saw them in the coach's box for the last match, but it'll be an interesting match. Hopefully,
I was around Brad Stein for 2 weeks in a row. My son was playing a challenger in Hawaii, and Brad Stein was assigned to coach him. But I really think the reason that Brad and all the national coaches, he was a national coach at that time, the reason they were there, because it was Hawaii. I mean, everybody was at that tournament. One thing about coming back to, I believe that Elaine is an ISTP and Carlos is an ESTP. And the late Vic Braden, I was flattered where he said, Steve, we should have had a plan. We should have trained players together and we should have trained just ISTPs and ESTPs. Don't even be discouraged. I mean, Roger Federer, for example, ENTP, and he did okay. But what the brain type is, they're in the moment. They're going with thought versus, you know, they're thinking versus their feeling, and they're flexible. You know, Yvonne told me this, that he hits the most drop shots on the tour. Right now, I guess he has that stat.
Is that an official stat?
You got to look it up. That's why you're here. You got your phone too, but I think you should wait, not get on your phone.
Could be. I mean, but there's a few other guys that come to mind. That wasn't that the lefty Frenchman that you met that trained with you for a little bit? Hugo.
He traveled with us for, we didn't really train him, but he couldn't speak. And for 4 months, I was driving tennis Europe and Hugo.
Gaston.
He was a younger, I think he was 12 and the other guys were 14. And in practice, you know, he was dropping sets. And I said to you guys, this guy, and he played a very unorthodox style. Well, yeah, definitely a drop shot. Very small guy. But the thing was, is he wasn't a roller coaster. He was just calm, and whether he was winning or losing, he was having fun. We had a young Canadian here not too long ago, or the last year and a half, just being here in Point Beach. Is, you know, he said, who has the best mindset of the players that you've met here over the last 12, 18 months? And this one kid's name comes up, or I bring his name up because just doesn't get his knickers in a twist. It's okay to lose. You know, the winners don't lose, they just run out of time. But Sinner, I did meet with a group of people that were here, and unfortunately I was in the hospital and didn't get a chance to work with their children, but we had a meeting, and I wasn't going to say very much, but we started because Sinner had been on TV the night before, Indian Wells, amazing player.
That's an interesting thing about Sinner is that you were talking about the mile in with the serve, and he has made a huge change in his serve. If you were to, you know, they've got, I saw it on YouTube. I saw a link. Someone broke it down, let's say, while he was Piotti, and then now that he's with Darren Cahill, it's a pretty big change that he's made on his serve. So, you know, I remember last year at the U.S. Open.
Was it tossed to the right, or what was he doing?
Tossed a little bit lower. The toss was much higher before. The racket is, he's coiled a little bit more, whereas before he had the racket quite low. So it was pretty interesting, the breakdown that they had, but the alignment of the feet to try to get a little bit more body rotation. So, I mean, if memory serves, last year when he played that epic match with Alcaraz at the U.S. Open, he must have double faulted in the double digits in that match. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't know the backstory as far as the changes that he was making with his serve. So it'll be interesting if that gets secured, you know. Does he lose these matches to Alcaraz in the future, whose second serve is pretty secure?
So I meet with a group of Canadian parents, Canadian players. I mean, there was a few Americans in the room. And the first thing I did is I showed the tape of Sinner from YouTube skiing as a 12-year-old. So it's just like, wow, and the guy is so chilled. And it's just fun to watch that tape. And, you know, I try to read and listen to as much as I can on Tennis Character. But, you know, the thing with Sinner is he thought those competitions were too fast, and he really liked the competition of tennis. He's quoted saying it could be 3 hours long and you got to figure it out. He definitely needs Band-Aid work on his volley. You know, he needs to volley better than, I'd say Alcaraz right now is a better volley. And the one thing about Alcaraz, the way he closes in, it's like Nadal.
So fast.
Nadal cuts down so much on the backhand volley because of the grip, but I mean, he's got the label now with some of these guys. McEnroe started it. He's the best volleyer in tennis, just the way he closes in. But center, he's somebody as well. It's that, the extroverts really need to work on being calm. And that Jim Leary used to always say, it's so tough to mix intensity and calmness at the same time. But in the end, I mean, footwork comes before racket work. People are sent to us for racket work. But footwork, then relaxation skills. But I think coming back to just talking about these two Indian Wells champions and singles, I mean, if you look at their ready position, if you look at the grip, if you look at the unit turn, and I hate the phrase, my mother used to say, don't use that word. I strongly dislike the term old school. I mean, there is no school. Old school, new school, no school. That, I mean, it's like, can't you see it? And granted, anything works. The brain, if you do it, you do something over and over again, you know, quantity beats quality. But then a young guy like this comes along, or Elaine as well, and obviously they have quantity. They've hit lots and lots of tennis balls, but they have quality. And, you know, I think really too many times tennis people look at the game from the top down. We have our four Super Bowls. We have the four majors. And, you know, like what went on with a Russian girl is going to go to her tennis training session. They're not going to shadow swing volleys, overheads, or serves, but they're going to go in a corner and like a prize fighter. I mean, I'm telling you, for like an hour before their hour lesson, they're going to shadow swing forehands and backhands. And they're not doing it. We're checkpoints and going slow. But it's circular, and the grips are close to being spot on. But I think that's my point with those two Indian Wells champions is that, and we're not claiming anything. The Great Base is a combination of all these different tennis teachers. You know, people think that, you know, and it's frustrating. Are you a great baser? And, you know, it's like, it's such a dumb question.
Yeah, because you would never hear, you know, it's like in baseball. And I love how I'm a huge baseball fan. So I always get a kick when you mention that kids don't even watch baseball anymore. But, you know, there was an era where you'd have certain batters like an Andres Galarraga who had an open stance when he batted. And, you know, you had people that were saying that that was the way everybody was going to bat in the future. And if you notice, everybody, I mean, not everybody, but maybe 98% of the 99% of the batters, they're still in a neutral, and if you want to use tennis terms, the neutral stance when they bat, you know, and everybody likes to like point out the exceptions to the rule. I remember as a Florida Marlin fan, Gary Sheffield had a huge sort of take back with a wiggle, and then you had other players like Edgar Renteria that kind of copied it. And then everybody's like, oh, this is the way it's going to bat. You know, everybody kind of, you know, you've always mentioned how the strength of the individual takes over and basically that overcomes everything. But just interesting watching, you know, nobody says that about baseball players. Oh, you have a great base with your batting stance. Or they never mention that with a basketball player when they're 90% from the free throw line that, oh, you've got a great base technique on your free throw. You know, they never mentioned that about, I remember going to a Dolphin game last year and watching the punter spend the entire game on the sideline, dropping the ball on the grass so he could drop it a perfect way. I mean, I was mesmerized watching him drop the ball perfectly. Like he couldn't rush it. He had to drop it a certain way. So when he went into the game, it was incredible how meticulous they were. For, you know, and I'm sure if I had watched the field goal kicker, he'd be doing something similar, right? But it's basically none of these people get criticized for having a strong fundamental base. But yes, tennis is the one that has to be the outlier, right? Like we need to return with a forehand grip. And, you know, it's kind of silly, but
it is. Oh, coming back to baseball, we used to always use different sports to teach tennis. I mean, okay, throwing a baseball, you're not up on the mound, but hey, it's like you're in center field and you're throwing the ball up over second base. Or, you know, we do this drill called the Billie Jean King shortstop drill. I mean, she was so good. she was a great baseball player. She played shortstop with the boys when she was a kid. And, you know, I was talking to a tennis parent the other day who played baseball, and he's got a little 7-year-old son, and I go, hey, he's got to don't back up, play the ball on the rise. It's like charging a ground ball. But here's a line that I think sums up what you were just saying about talking about the differences is rumor is much more important. Rumor is much more interesting than fact. I was in a setting, and there's certainly I think these type of things go on, I think, in every walk of life, but someone was spreading this rumor that, use my name third person, Steve Smith, he's sleeping with these college girls. I guess we're going off the G channel here, the PG. And one of the parents said, you know, I think he's sleeping with his racket. My comment to that is I can't even get a date. But I mean, there was a college, there was a coach in that situation that, I mean, I knew for a fact. But yeah, the rumor mill, you know, I did have someone mention this to me. I think it's very important is that we need to make sure that we don't come across this way like we were beating up tennis parents. We have this article on our podcast, why do players switch coaches so often? And, you know, you really have to think about the parent. Hey, you know, give it a year, don't give it a weekend. But if your child's at a facility, you know, Braden used to say, find the kid who's the ice cream goes in the forehead and see how they play tennis. Look at how the worst athlete plays tennis. And then you know if they're teaching tennis well. But yeah, the rumor mill, I do think that a lot of times I've said this and got a laugh where the teaching pro talks about parents and the parents talk about teaching pros. But tennis teaching is just not fact-based. Let's just do this for 1 second. We'll come back to tennis. I'll go fast.
You going back to Rocky?
I go to visit this old friend, Rocky Balboa. Rocky 1 was in 76, and Rocky 2, 79, Rocky 3, 82, Rocky 4, 85, Rocky 5, 90, Rocky 6, 2006. I think it's okay, but I was really, really discouraged when the name was changed to Creed 1. I thought it should have been Rocky 7 in 2015, Rocky 8 in 2018, and Rocky 9 this year. It's 47 years. And with that, I do have some things for a trivia test, but I think every athlete needs to watch Rocky 1. I tell young kids, no, what's your favorite? And they pick Rocky 4. I do this in coaching workshops, have a quiz, and I'll say something like, yo, Tommy, I didn't hear no bell. You know, and it's, hey, yo, Tommy, my ring's outside. And it's Rocky 5. And people just badmouth Rocky 5. I mean, it's Hollywood. And they're certainly, Rocky 1 is the closest to reality. And it's just so well done. But here are a few things on Rocky. My oldest brother, he was part of the crew with the New York Rangers. He was an assistant coach. And I thought it was 15 rounds, but I believe it was 12. They used to have lots of rounds, and the guys at the bottom really—it's a Cinderella story if they make it. But they drafted Rocky Balboa. Now here's a guy, Freddie Foreman. I have to get this in, inside joke. He's from North Dakota, which makes Freddie Foreman—I should say—which makes Dave Anderson the second best tennis teacher in the history of North Dakota. I'm sure there's a lot of great tennis teachers from North Dakota, but Freddie and Anderson—they're childhood buddies. And actually, Freddie got into tennis later. So who's the better athlete? And my line is, I think that Anderson could only beat him at putt-putt. You know, it was ping pong and softball and basketball and wrestling. And so anyway, Freddie pulls this off. Talking about a little beer drinking, it was great that he hung around me for 3 years instead of two. He's Instant Party. That was a nickname he had. So he takes his group of teenage boys. And I go back to looking at this year in 85, so I had quite a few things going on with this big, big program and such. So Freddie, he gets the guys up, and he's the one who takes five raw eggs, and he drinks the raw eggs. And the sun isn't up. So they're having this training session. And so they watch Rocky 1. I mean, lunch is packed. They have a short practice. They watch Rocky II, and they have a short practice, and they watch Rocky III. And then when Rocky IV came out, I went with them to the movie theater, and I was the only one who was awake. So I have Freddie and these teenage tennis players, all guys, and they're all sound asleep. That was back in the day of regular school. But boxing, this is my favorite boxing story, one of the highlights of my journey in tennis. I was teaching outside of Manhattan. I was out in the Hamptons. I mean, it was a really nice place. Across the street was the ocean. And there was a fundraiser, and there was a band, and everything was done on the courts. And there were these two hard courts. You know, they put down mats, and the band was over on the clay court, and there's tables, and it's festive. So Andy Brandy and I were on the second hard court because people were watching on the first hard court. And they had to pay $100. The participants, they paid $100. So it's $100 each. And two people would come out. And they, if they won 3 points, they would get their $200 back plus an additional $200. And you know, people weren't even wearing tennis shoes. They're coming out in street shoes. And it just kept going and going. Everybody was playing. And I guess the more champagne, the more points were played. So Rocky Marciano, he was a heavyweight champion of the world, 1952 to 1955. His first name was Rocco. Still holds the record. It's tied with Joe Louis for the longest time to be the heavyweight champion. So everybody knew Rocky Marciano. They used to always talk about Laver's forearm was the same size. His left forearm was the same size as Rocky Marciano's both forearms. But then there was Rocky Graciano, same time. And he was a heavy... the lightweight champion, not the heavy champion, or the lightweight, I guess it's called. His middle name was Rocco. And he was so popular, he could easily pass Madison Square Garden. Troubled childhood, trouble in the army, but he got through all that. Went AWOL and, he ended up in a juvie center and did some jail time. But he came back and had... it was in movies. There was a movie made about him. I've got this in my notes, but I'll come to that. And if people watch the movie that was made about him, Somebody Up There Likes Me, then you could see that it really influenced Rocky. He was a favorite of Johnny Carson's. You Google Rocky Graciano, Johnny Carson. So let me go back down here. So Rocky Graciano comes out. He's got the nice gray slacks and the black shoes. And a white shirt, necktie. And he comes out and he's standing in the ad court. He's hanging out of the racket like this. He has never played tennis. And because it was at this place where I was teaching, I used to imitate the pros. And I had Jimmy Connors down. I went one time did Jimmy Connors serve for Jimmy Connors. He didn't think it was funny, but people thought that I did Jim Connors better than Jimmy Connors. So, just copying all the rituals and all the idiosyncrasies. So Vic Braden, Jimmy got mad at Vic because Jimmy had a great grunt. And Vic said, his serve goes 72 miles an hour. His grunt goes 104. And he actually worked with Gideon Ariel and Vic Braden at one time. And they got the toss. He was so far over his head. As a left, he was tossing so far right. I one time was in a pro shop. Maybe I've mentioned this on the podcast. I was asked to just watch for a few minutes, and under this glass cabinet was the listing of the 1 through 7, the NTRP. And he comes in, and I said, like he's Oaktel, I said, sir, if you just read 1 through 7, you tell us your level of play, we can find you a game. Just treat the famous like they're not and the famous like they are, or no, vice versa. Tongue twister. So anyway, I'm on the court with Andy Brandy, Rocky Graciano, and some other person who's never played tennis before. So I would say it's a large audience. I would guess 350. And so someone knows me and they yell out, give him your Jimmy Connors. Give him your Jimmy Connors. So, I would do the same thing, toss
over. Did you go lefty?
No. I didn't go lefty. I certainly shook my head and moved the gold necklace and the way I hit the bottom of my shoes and rocked back and forth. So someone yells out, give him the Jimmy. And... even if I was trying to serve my best, I didn't serve 72, but So anyway, I toss it way over my head, has a funny bounce, and it hits him right square in the chest. Boom. And I'm telling you, the band stopped. I mean, it was just so quiet. So it was kind of like, uh-oh. And, you know, I put my hand up, and he puts his hand up, even though he's not a tennis player. So anyway, here's the highlight, is we come to the net, you know, you shake hands with the person in front of you, and you shake hands this way. So he's looking at me straight here, and he's a righty. And I'd have to double check that too. But anyway, he shook hands right-handed. He might have been a left-handed boxer. He shook my hand right-handed, and he took his hand, which is like the paw of a lion, and he just slapped me right across the head. I mean, my bell was ringing. I mean, what was I going to do, hit him back? And I was just like this, and the whole place was laughing. So then he goes off the court. Needless to say, Andy Brady and I, we didn't lose 3 points. And he goes off the court, and he's got his arms up like this, and he's shadow boxing because he had to go from the second court to the first court. And the people went crazy. And what was amazing after that is, you know, the tennis comes to an end, and I remember him coming over and giving me a beer. And it's like, okay, Rocky and I are buddies. But Paul Newman, look it up. Somebody up there likes me, and it's a movie about Rocky Graziano. I have some trivia here, I think. Maybe not. I hope I do. No, it's not here in my notes. But, yeah, it's just like, okay, here's some questions. What are the name of, I don't need the notes, but what are the name of Rocky's turtles?
You're asking the wrong guy here. I'm not a connoisseur.
You're asking the wrong guy. I told a story the other day. My son, Mikhail, was here, and he was like the perfect child, did everything he was told, and you know, he turned 13, but Vic Braden has spent a lot of time working with him. Vic was 5'6". And it worked out. We were in Orlando at the Vic Braden Tennis College, and it's a rainy day. And maybe I've told this story. I got to put that book together. Have someone help me with my stories. We could talk about that for a second. So anyway, it rains. It's like an all-day rain. And I remember wanting my former wife to go, you know, strange and wonderful relationship. I'm strange and she was wonderful, and she's nervous, very therapeutic. She said, well, you know, Vic, you're really your friend. And I'm thinking, no, he's my mentor. And so anyway, the three of us are there, and Vic just loved Mikhail, and, you know, was sky high about his tennis. And, you know, Mikhail had the record to prove it. He never learned to lose, actually. And they're really, you know, people know the history of the 10 and under kids. So he says to Mikhail, I have no idea what Mikhail's going to say. Vic goes, what's the problem? And Mikhail goes, I'm short. And Vic goes, you're talking to the wrong guy. But, you know, it was a point in time where his little brother became, you know, a few inches taller. I mean, certainly there's a lot more to it than that. But, yeah, with Rocky, trivia questions. The name of the dog, Butkus. The actors, Yo Adrian, you know, just like, what was his wife's name? What was the brother's name? Yo Paulie. And, you know, there's just so many great lines. What did Rocky say after he said, Paulie was my best friend? He was my best friend, but he wasn't very friendly. I mean, the humor is, it's dry, but it's this, yeah, assignment for coaches, junior tennis players. They can't play another tournament until they at least watch Rocky one. I mean, so it was fun to visit an old friend.
Wasn't one of your COVID things to watch Breaking Bad?
Well, it wasn't intentional. Andy Fitzell, I refused at first. And you're like, well, how long is this? He says, 43 hours. So I go, no way am I watching that.
And then, that one I can help you with. That one I can help you with as far as trivia. But the Rocky, I am not a strong. I'm not strong on that trivia.
Now, I recently met someone with the name Jesse, and it's like Jesse, and it's like, you know, then it's just like, bitch, yo, bitch. Uh-oh.
Pinkman.
Edit that
you gotta,
out.
You got to go with Pinkman. That this is going to be the all-time record for beeps in this podcast.
I'd have to say with Breaking Bad, it's been a long, long time since I've looked at a YouTube clip Breaking Bad. But I know people that have once a week, they, you know, like every Tuesday, let's come on over, we'll have tacos and beers or whatever, and they, it's a Breaking Bad.
That could be me, actually.
You could throw that party. You want to go to that party?
hard pressed for anybody to convince me there's a better TV series out there.
But with boxing to tennis, Jimmy Connors, his uncle was a boxer. Andre Agassi's father was an uncle.
Father was an uncle?
Yeah, help me out. Straighten that out. That's.
I heard the other day that Davidovich Fokina's father is also a boxer.
Yeah, I read that. It's amazing with, why do boxers have such great footwork? Because they don't want to get hit again. And, that routine of skipping rope, 3 minutes on, 1 minute off. I mean, Jack Kramer, we tell kids, hey, if there was a number on your sleeve, we told you 5 years ago, so we take 5 times 365. We told you 12 minutes a day, which was only 9 minutes of skipping rope, 3 minutes go, 1 minute off. And you could do abs, you could shout some of your serve, you could just rest. And just to do three, just do that round. We did it not too long ago where we had people do an entire hour. You know, skip 45 minutes. And, what's better, a computer for your tennis or a skip rope? Skip rope. I mean, there's certainly modern technology, but in so many ways, you don't really need it. It's good to look at film, but I mean, I know with, going through things in slow motion, but if I watch a tennis match and I come in and I'm going to do the charting on the match, I tell the young players, I said, I don't really, it's fun to have the film, but I don't really need this. I see it when it happens. But, almost 50 years later, but no, there's certainly a mentality of survival with boxers, and it's with Sharapova. A lot of players. We hired a boxer two different times, and again, going back, all these stories, things that come to your mind. I can remember this guy was great, but he had a drinking problem, and I felt so bad because. When he came to our place, I can't remember whether it was fourth DWI and he got it on the way home and I had to do jail time. He was a very, very bright guy as well. And the kids loved him. I mean, but any type of training, you can't do it for a weekend. I mean, if you're going to get into boxing, but just take the routines of a boxer and the drills of a boxer. And, you talk about basketball, but that's where, there's contact sports. How's it going? No, there's collision sports, contact sports, non-contact sports. And boxing is really, it can be a death sport. I mean, it's just amazing. But what else you got? Let's talk about a few more things before we sign off. What do you got? Tennis. Let's go with tennis.
I don't know if you touch base on the Wintergreen. Is that so you are not going to be there this summer?
No, go to the hospital. I waited for 3 days. I was always very dumb. Wait for 3 days. That last day, I mean, I was throwing up like a slot machine. Just over and over and over again. You get to the point where there's nothing really to, as far as vomiting. And so it's funny. I go to this first place, and I can't go inside. So then they send us to this first emergency, first ER. And I'm not there that long, but they do an MRI and guy comes in the room, the doctor, and he's a Smith. And he looks at me, well, I just have to tell you my initial report is the way I'm trained. And then I tell people, oh, no, they're not trained that way. And he goes, you got to go to another place. They got to take more time and, what film work or whatever. And he goes, but you're going to be horribly lucky if you don't have cancer. So as soon as he said that to me, I said, your last name's Smith, right? He goes, yeah. I said, well, I'm a Smith. There's a blacksmith, a goldsmith, a coppersmith, and then Yvonne's in the room. And I said, see this son of a, he sinned. The moral of the story is if you're a Smith, you've never sinned. But fortunately, I went in and no food or water for 5 days. People call it the C word. But I was just beat up. I mean, there's exhaustion and there's... being dehydrated, and there's also no sleep, and there's also, decades of just grinding it, things like, well, and people have worked with me, it's like, yeah, this is, we've gone 90 days in a row where we've gone to Subway for lunch, or more like 900 days in a row where you've had it since you've had a day off.
And I'm used to getting your text at 5 a.m. So, and on the previous one at midnight. So you definitely don't sleep much.
No. I mean, that's, I remember working with John Doran and then his younger brother, Garrett Doran. And Garrett Doran, maybe there was a beautiful girl on the other end, but some girl, I think, in Ecuador, that'd be my guess. Because his father had gone down there to do some work, and they're breaking down poetry. And the guy just, because it was a different time zone, and the guy just wasn't sleeping. And I remember him just saying, you know, sleep is for the soft. Yeah, I mean, when you get up early, you're not really in pain, but you think about what your brain needs. And so, yeah, it's just time for me to regroup. And I do think I can work in tennis education. And, you know, my strength is my weakness. Just a couple of days before, there was two young 17-year-old kids here, and boys, and they want to play college tennis. And we don't advertise, but our network is, it is what it is. And, you know, people here, there, and everywhere that worked with us. And so these young guys come in, we do the film work, and it's March, and they want to come back in April, and they want to come back in the summer. And they just clearly, it's pointed out to them what they need to do to get better. And a 17-year-old can do that. I know we're going to interview Rye Tarpley coming up, and just to get the story out there that, you know, he's in his 20s, and I tell him, well, you want to be the best player in the country at 35, and he wasn't playing at 35, but in 40 became number one in the country. Steve Campbell's wife, his team at Wintergreen, beautiful, beautiful place, and I'm sure I'll end up doing some projects there, but I think, you know, just the advice I'm getting is it's a little bit too big a pill to, you know, eat the elephant one bite at a time. But yeah, so anyway, knock on wood, you know, we take health for granted. And so what I had was really not that serious. But if I don't take care of it, you know, you just, you know, it's not drugs and alcohol. It's nothing, you know, people have, I mean, my roommate, I had several roommates over 10 days, and this, you know, one guy is just way, way overweight and circulation problems. And, you know, he's still going, you know, they're telling him he's got to quit smoking. And he goes, I can't quit smoking. And, you know, he's 74. And it's not like we were in a position where we chatted that much, but it's quite interesting. There's a young teenage guy was in there, and it's like, whoa. But actually, when I was told that about cancer, I think of two other Steves. Steve Rose, who became like a big brother to me, helping me when I was a perennial tennis bum at Boca Raton. And Steve Squire from England. He played tennis with like 5 years in a row. And they both lost their life to stomach cancer. I mean, stomach cancer is, it's like, okay, well, you know, you got to say your goodbyes pretty quick. But also that leads me to thinking about the Great Base and, you know, putting a book together and, you know, Vic Braden's death and the communication I had with Vic prior to that. And, you know, he used to just say, that, you know, we should have had this plan. We should have had that plan. And I remember a young Jeff Lewis putting this workshop together. And it was fantastic because, you know, fortunately, I was always in a position where I was listening to Vic. And I wasn't going to go outside and eat orange slices or go shoot some basketball. So I was just going to listen to everything over and over again. He's given the same lecture every Tuesday. And it's like, no, he's going to say something different. Even if it's just one little thing. And I remember Jeff had asked him, you know, why didn't he get in a position of certifying pros? And he said, I should have. I mean, he did have a program where pros would go and take a test. You know, certification, how's it go? Certification is not education. But yeah, the plan I used to tell Vic is, yeah, you need to go forward with a flashlight and make all these new discoveries, and I need to go backwards and hit people over the head with a club. And, but he knew that I was doing the character side of it. And so anyway, Jeff put this clinic together, and it was Vic and myself, and Vic would speak and I would speak. And so Vic used to say about a kid, he'd leave the room. He's such a nice guy. Uncle Vic, everybody get to know him, and it seemed like he was your favorite uncle. And So Vic would leave the room and go, that kid's game. What game? He's got no game. And my approach was I just told him to their face. I put it on film, got the parents in the room. You know, I had a skill test, and Vic loved basketball. That was his favorite sport. You know, the line where the guy's in the rowboat and he's got a basketball and he's in the ocean, and the coach goes, that kid can't hit water. And I mean, that's, you know, we put very highly ranked juniors through a skills test, and we say, hey, come up and hit a volley cross court in the service box and grip swing. I mean, the service box is the size of the same room we're in right now. It's small, like a small sitting room, and it's 21 by 13 and a half, and you feed the ball 30 miles an hour and you go, here it comes. And, you know, the parents have spent thousands and thousands of dollars on tennis, and the poor kid, he doesn't know. I mean, it's just tennis ignorance. And, you know, that's where a group of us, and with your help and so many others, that's what the great base is, and Braden is the cornerstone, is it's not ever going to be irrelevant. You know, again, coming back to these two young champions, Elena, what's her last name?
Rybakina.
And Carlos?
Alcaraz.
Yeah, I mean, they're so fundamentally sound. But then when you go to these weekend tournaments, the Battle of Boca, and these people, the people are there, they want to play pro tennis. And it's like, we used to say that everybody, the only thing people agreed upon years ago was a ready position. Right? No, they agreed on a lot of things. Granted, you know, years ago, people were off on the forehand. But I mean, now the modern forehand, if someone were to tell me that's the way a snake goes down a hole, I would say, yeah, okay. But that's not how people are hitting a forehand. You know, people on our podcast, I think people for listening to it, is that the recovery is the follow through. The follow through can't be seen with the human eye. And I know those two young players.
But it's interesting that people just want to almost prepare themselves mentally to say, I'm going to be the exception to, you know, I'm going to grip my racket this way. And, you know, if you look at the history of tennis, for the most part, it's generally followed a certain level of similarities, be it the serve, be it the ground strokes, be it the volleys or what have you. And yet someone, when you approach them with a flaw technically they may have, they almost want to be the exception, as opposed to like breaking it down, starting over and relearning it. You know, it seems like it's only like that in tennis. You know, it's in any other sport, if you have a flaw, it usually gets tackled right away. You know, a guy like Tim Tebow was a Heisman Trophy winner and first round draft pick. And they basically told him from the beginning that, when he got to the NFL, that this is not going to work here. You know, what if he was molded as a pocket passer at a younger age? The guy had all the winner qualities you'd want from an athlete.
No, I think I've mentioned that before. It's a great story. Neil Anderson came to take tennis lessons. He went that film. He went through all 25 hours of Tennis Intelligible three times, came back, said to me, laughing, he smiled on his face. He goes, it's not going to work. I go, I know, it's too much work. People won't do the work. You know, it's amazing the gift of jockocracy. I was at, Dave Anderson's place. He owns it, but, so I'm out there doing a weekend course for coaches. I'm going back decades, right? And then afterwards, Craig Carden, who, I mean, coached a lot of players, but he was Martina's coach at one time. He was not at that time. He was doing a USTA clinic. And so I remember telling Anderson, perfect, I'll do my clinic and I'll stay and I'll watch the USTA clinic. And, you know, I remember Craig Carden saying about world team tennis, yeah, you got to talk all day and say nothing. You know, really at the top, I mean, you know, you get in the inner circle of what's going on with these two players we're talking about today. I mean, come on, total respect, but also to go way back to the beginning, total respect. You know, I've been told, I went through the Spanish system, that's the one thing in Spain is that if you're out there teaching beginners or you're out there teaching elite players, you're on the same page and there's camaraderie. And, you know, here it's, you know, that's one thing people like about the U.S. It's such an individualistic place and it's such an easy way to, I mean, difficult for some, for sure, easier for others. But if you wanted, you know, the land of opportunity, I mean, if you wanted, you know, do such and such. I mean, I remember the former West Germany used to have to get permission from the government to move. Not East Germany, West Germany. I remember Craig saying to me, Craig Carden, you know, junior tennis. I don't know junior tennis, but I know pro tennis. And obviously there's a big difference. We always say little kid and big kid, little kid tennis and big kid tennis. You have to overload the amount of time you work on fundamentals in little kid tennis. You can't neglect becoming an athlete. But, you know, Tiley's name, Craig Tiley, spent 7 years with his name comes up all the time, and he became an outstanding recruiter, you know, sell ice to the Eskimos at the University of Illinois. And obviously before the team went up one level, next level, next level, it's a great Rocky Balboa type story where they go from obscurity, no one will even play them, and then they win the national championship. And I know a lot about that story. I was there with, you know, Jennifer Roberts before, and, you know, Tiley's first trip to Illinois, he went to help me run a workshop. I was in the room. He said nothing and except thank you, thank you, thank you. I remember going into the room and, you know, I remember Jennifer Roberts just reprimanded me because we were just in a restaurant. I'm telling jokes and stories. And she goes, what are you going to do when you go in this room? I said, I'm going to let the guy talk. And, you know, the University of Illinois versus Tyler Junior College, I mean, some of these universities, I mean, they have their own post office. They have their own hotel. And I just, you know, just told him this small place we worked at. And he's just started talking, and I just started asking him all these questions. And, he, you know, people, he and, you know, Bob Todd, he was the interim. And Tyler went in as a director of instruction. He didn't go in as a tennis coach. But anyway, years later, I mean, Tyler, and what really helped him out through his experience in Tyler, Texas, was, you know, we had John Lafnidiaga. You know, it was really Russell Seymour. Russell Seymour was at one time the director of South African tennis, and he loved Texas, and he ended up getting a job that this gentleman, it was like a scene from Dallas, Harry Phillips, wanted me to be the pro at Holly Tree. And, you know, I go, I'm not going to become the pro at Holly Tree. He goes, yes, you are. It's public domain. He knew what I was making. He goes, I'll easily pay you three times what you're being paid now. I said, no, I'll help you out. And I was the interim director of Holly Tree at one time, and they ended up eventually bringing in someone I trained back in those days. But they, Russell Seymour, Jason Morton. Jason Morton was in the chair. He was the umpire during the Bobby Riggs, Billie Jean King match. It's great to talk to people like that. So anyway, they were both great senior players. It was even at a point where Russell was in conversation with him about going to South Africa. I go, yeah, maybe you'd be interested in that. Nothing really transpired with that. But so he sent us young players. First group with John Lafnidiaga, Kostas Skopelaitis, just two players. And, you know, it was an elevator ride with Diaga came and worked with me, but later he worked with Tiley. And, you know, he's coached Fed Cup and Davis Cup, and he's coached that Indian team. If you go to his Fed Facebook, it's a picture of him coaching Federer. That Indian Leagues was short-lived, perhaps, or it's still going. But anyway.
IPTL.
Yeah. So, and then the next group comes through and Jeff Cotsier becomes a player. But anyway, when Tiley was recruiting, so from that experience, he people used to beat him up. Oh, he's not a player. He's a very good school player. He played tennis well. And, you know, Ty Tucker back in the Ohio State versus Illinois, is he a 3-5 player? You know, he could definitely play. And so anyway, he didn't have any background in college tennis. I mean, he came in and he was in a class that I taught, and he was there 7 years, and Jennifer Roberts taught it. He actually taught the class, but he couldn't teach the class. So I had to be in the class. So I sat in the back and gave him the opportunity to teach a class, which you could do in academia. I mean, I think it's a problem too many times when the student assistant is grading the papers. So he knew a lot about the NCAAs. I mean, Chad Clark and Julie Scott, he was there when they were being developed, and they both went on and won national titles. So he knew tennis well before he went to Illinois. And, Neil Adams was fired, and Jennifer was good friends with the athletic director, Ron Gunther, the new athletic director. And it just worked out where he was hired on an interim basis. And then from there, you know, he basically got rid of everybody. He went to the intramural department. But he did really well. I remember Jameson Hawthorne was a great personality, great kid, and he was number one in the second division. I hated the names. They've changed them, thankfully. Texas football. The first one was Super Champ, and then Champ, and then the poor kid in the lowest level was called Regular. And these kids would just say to each other, you Champ, you Super Champ, you Soup Up. And I'm just shaking my head. I said, you just got to be able to spin your serve and rally four times, and you can be a Super Champ. He's 12 and unders. But long story short is Tiley would say when he was recruiting, because he became the Davis Cup captain while he was at Illinois, And even before that, he's like Dick Gould. Like, how did Dick Gould become Dick Gould? Like Craig Tiley, sharp guy. They both could be CEOs. I mean, Tiley is a CEO. You know, Dick Gould, he had the Junior Davis Cup at Stanford, and that put him on the map. His personality, those all the best juniors in America would go to Stanford every summer. And, you know, Dick Gould didn't have a telephone call. It wasn't like they came in for a two-day visit. He got to really know them. And the way it worked out, some of them were there more than one summer. So, you know, he won 17 national championships and so many things. Dick Gould, smart guy. I mean, McEnroe comes in and he's already been in the semis of Wimbledon. And he goes, you can come out of the courts when you want to. It's a funny story. So it's almost mid-October. And, you know, even though he did so well, it wasn't like the ranking. He got into the Cal Palace, San Francisco wild card. And Dick Gould knocks on his door and he's in there jamming on his guitar. And he goes, John, I think, you know, you got that wild card coming up. You ought to practice a few days. And, you know, you played doubles with Arthur Ashe one time. So I can ramble and go on different tangents. But so Tiley, Jameson Hawthorne was recruited, and that's who Tiley was recruiting. Tier two players from Texas. Like, who wants to go to Champaign, Illinois, the cornfields? And, I mean, talk about putting a place on the map, but they just got better. And where he really did his work was when he was taking really good sectional players. Here's a story with the older Zeter, Nathan Zeter. He beats a player from Tampa, Florida. I won't give his name, but he was a star in Florida. And he was ranked way ahead of Zeter. But, you know, it's indoors, and Zeter's, you know, not quite as tall as his father, and he beats his player. And the two moms talk. And, you know, next thing I know is the younger Zeter is coming to work with me. And, but, you know, Tiley rebuilt games. But by the end, you know, he certainly worked with players, but it was more like an NBA coach. You know, I mean, he's very clever, you know, getting I think it's a Fab Five recruiting class. Delek and Stolt and Calkins. And, you know, it was a year later that he had Rahm and DeHart come in, if I get my math right. So long story short is that Tiley would say to recruits, well, I know the pro game. And I used to say he wouldn't say that if I was in the room because the game's the game. You know, that's one of the biggest problems we have in tennis is the former players. Unlike yourself or Tiley, I mean, I got so I could hit a ball back and forth. And it's the credibility factor. If you're if you hold majors, you're going to get a job on TV. You're going to get a microphone. And, I know the pro game. But even before the players from South Africa, then he became Davis Cup, is a clever guy. What Tiley did is he went to the alumni, and I was told by Tiley, it's got to be way up there. I mean, he can sell ice to the Eskimos, but the largest alumni in tennis, or I should say in universities. So he finds out who from Illinois is really successful, and he calls them up to sponsor tournaments. And when you do that, you own a wild card. I think Tiley was up to like 42 wild cards when he was a coach. And, you know, then the USTA at one time said no more pro tournaments on college campuses. Came out and said, that's it. And someone said, what about Kalamazoo? And everybody loves Kalamazoo, the tradition. So the committee had to go back and change. So, okay, now these college universities, when they hold a pro tournament, that's very enticing to a kid to go there because the coach holds some wild cards. I think wild cards are fluff, but I think you got to make it from the bottom up. And, you know, kids from other countries, I mean, here in the U.S. where we have a lot of tournaments, there's a lot of wild cards. But that's a long story on, you know, the pro game. I mean, the game's the game. My brother Mike used to say, peewee hockey and NHL hockey are the same. A bad pass is a bad pass. A fundamental is a fundamental. And then you go even further, John Wooden. The fundamental doesn't change. The speed at which you have to execute that fundamental changes. But a closing comment for me would be, Indian Wells champions, Elena
Rybakina,
Carlos
Alcaraz.
Solid fundamentals. Well, they have a great base.
We can't forget we had the oldest winner in Masters history in Indian Wells. Did you know that?
Bopana.
Bopana.
Bopana. How do you say his first name?
Rohan.
Rohan Bopana. I'll tell you Rohan Bopana story.
43 years old, and he wins the doubles.
I'll tell you a friend, Arvin Down, has had conversations with him because so many of them get in the academy, and it's amazing to watch him. It's like, no, this guy's not that impressive, but then when you watch. So Arvin sets it up with Ram Ramanathan, two U.S. Opens. One, Andy was with me. We did some training and Philadelphia, and that's where Arvin's based. So I go to the U.S. Open qualies, and the Indian players watch the Indian players. And I'm charting, and Rom's a great kid. And all these years later, he's still stuck in the mud. I mean, he's 150, big serve. When he's 14, he won the championship, the nationals in India. Then he went to the famous place in Spain, here in Naples, Florida.
Sanchez Casal.
And a lot of respect for them. But he goes there. He doesn't win one match. He never plays a junior tennis match again. He goes there, and at that time, it was, I understand this, the Spaniards had 50 futures. So the economics, so you didn't have to travel. It's like when you go to the Orange Bowl, you go, okay, wait a minute, people from Spain aren't traveling. Years back, it's like, what's going on? And there's only one type of point. There's WTA points and there's ATP points. And parents just don't get that. And teaching pros as well. If you're really going to be good, you're going to play with lines people. So don't cheat now. And so you got a senior moment. You got to bring me back here. Where were we?
Were we talking about Philadelphia?
Oh, yeah. So I go to the U.S. Open and Rohan Bopana. So he's there. And, I had been introduced to him because of practice sessions, the Indian players. And all the players get along. But when you go into the lounge or wherever the pros are, the huge area, the Swedes will sit with the Swedes and the Germans sit with the Germans. This is in the men's. They all get along. Not so much in the women. They all have a male sparring partner. And maybe it's a little better than it has been, but... it's just because, okay, the humor, the dialect, and whether you're talking about your local soccer team, anyway, Rohan's around Arvin quite a bit. And so we're sitting down at that area right before you go where the players and coaches go in, and it's a little lounge area, a little bit of grass, and it's kind of a nice place to have a picnic. So we sit down and I say, wait a minute. I went through things very quickly and I said, okay, wait a minute, just sit here. And I go into the players' lounge, and Rohan, we need 10, 15 minutes of your time. He came right out. And, I went through it. I mean, you can't go 187 points and not hit a plus on the backhand return. And, you got to go forward, and you got to have net appearances. But he plays that one-dimensional game, and, he's had some results. I think he was in the finals where he lost to Stevie Johnson, he gets to an ATP final. I think with Raven Clausen, he got to the ATP final, the one up in Newport where there's still bad grass. And, Raven goes, he's told me, I wish I didn't get to that final because I would have focused on doubles sooner. Hmm. And that was a point where Raven helped out. Raven's been on our podcast and Austin Krychek. And, Raven was telling him that, to make money, he had a good go in singles. Krychek was top 100. But now, finally, he's on the Davis Cup team. He's on the Olympic team. He's top 10 in the world. It's interesting. He was born in 1990. So hopefully, knock on wood, he's still got 10 years left. But no, I was watching that with that one match with Robert Wojciech, Carla's husband. And he goes, we got to watch Rohan. It's great that, that's just not on TV enough. Come on. There's all this talk over and over again. Do they show the juniors? Do they show the doubles? And, how many times over and over again, these two great players we've been talking about, Elena and Carlos, they're great, great, great. But like you said, television coverage, we're just covering the marquee players. And that, in doubles, when it was changed to, at one point, Tiley being a tournament director, I think at Carl Hale in Canada, at one point they were talking about dropping doubles.
Yeah, Riley Opelka has been pretty outspoken as of late trying to get rid of doubles. Which, I don't know. I can kind of see his point, but when you see how pickleball has just exploded in popularity, if high level doubles were shown more often, I think you'd actually get a little bit more viewership. So basically, my favorite term was always the year end championship, when they would always play the doubles before the singles matches at the O2 Arena. But even the women's final was great. I mean, you were talking about Yana Novotná earlier, and the girl that she basically molded was now I can't say the name. Barbara Krejcikova.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she with her doubles partner, they played a great match against the Brazilian woman and the little German girl, Siegmann. It was interesting. I mean, I saw a strategy that I'd never seen before. I saw the serving team playing two back, and then Siegmann serving and volleying. It was kind of interesting. So, but there are differences in the doubles, and if they were to show it a little bit more, I mean, again, they can package it. I mean, if it's short enough, you can do a better job presenting it for TV.
Even to show the 10-point tiebreaker.
I mean, look at this week. I mean, Tommy Paul is playing doubles with Brian Shelton. I'm sorry, Ben Shelton, and they're in the quarters.
What was the mistake I made on Shelton?
Yes, you've corrected it. I was here when you corrected it.
Todd Whitkin passed away so early. Beat Connors at the US Open, and that's his uncle. On the wife's side.
But, you know, like, how is that not an interesting thing for viewers to watch? I mean, Ben Shelton is probably the next big thing when it comes to U.S. tennis.
Oh, just a smile.
Just show him in doubles. I mean, Tommy Paul has been having a great year. I mean, just right there, we can just show that. Do we really need to see a replay the next day of an 0-2 singles match? I mean, it's just...
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Even, yeah, like the next day when the Tennis Channel is not live. Right,
exactly. I mean, you already know the results. I mean, just show some of the matches that you didn't catch the day before. So,
you know, I've met his dad a few times. He's come to recruit players that I've worked with and when he was at Georgia Tech. And great, great guy. And has a good connection with Bill Timm. Great story there. But people need our podcast. They need to go back and listen to Scotty Perelman. He's the volunteer.
Right.
And you know, I'll send him a message. I go, yeah, Shelton's amazing, but you know, and Scotty Perelman's like Vic Brady. You know, he's like that 5'6" guy. I go, Perelman, you got more talent. You're pinky than that guy. You know, he's just laughing. But I communicate quite a bit with Matt Clore, though. Both are support coaches for Brian. And yeah, I was down here in Delray Beach watching him practice. And the kid's just a natural. He's just, I know, I would say no stage fright, very personable.
I mean, and. So he's not in the singles anymore. I mean, we can't show him in doubles. We can't show. It's just poorly done. So I mean, basically,
yeah. No, but you know, that's where we get to see Coco Gauff. I mean,
yeah, we see her playing with Pegula doubles all the time. I mean, we see her plenty in singles
with McNally before that.
Right, correct.
With what was the name? Barbara, the last name you couldn't pronounce.
Krejcikova.
She's won many mixed, right? That's the gal.
She's won many doubles. I mean, they were talking about her. And Siniavakova being a Hall of Fame doubles team because I guess they've won 7 or 8 Grand Slams now. So
well, this came from Nick White, who's the head coach at Skidmore. He's a student of ours from way back when, or I shouldn't really say that. I mean, everybody's a student initially, but then associate. So I don't know the connection, even though we feel like we're so much on the outside. But it's like, wow, there's some connections here. So he calls me up. And he met her and spent some time with her. And I don't know what capacity, but was saying she needs to play mixed with Raven Klaassen. So I make a phone call and, you know, Klaassen gets on the phone and, you know, he says, no, I'm a terrible mixed player. You know, maybe he's the guy who can't hit the gal, but, you know, doesn't have the huge serve and quick as a cat. But but I want to come back to Riley Opelka. I mean, I certainly heard that from Rob Krajicek. You know, proud papa, rightfully so. And Sherry just shaking her head. He hangs out a little bit at the Battle of Boca. I mean, he's like a walking tree, right? I mean, you can't miss him. And I've been introduced to him. I don't know him, but I know my son knows him. My son used to, everybody that I know who knows him, say they really like the guy. And my son said, I ever like everything about Riley Opelka except when he hugs me. He goes, he's like, I mean, I don't like coming up to his navel when he hugs me. He's still so tall. My son played him at Wimbledon. My son played him after he won Junior Wimbledon. My son, I can't remember, he squeaked it out. He's much older, but he was aced 24 times by Opelka. But Opelka, I mean, that's where I would be critical of the USTA. He was there a long, long time, and it's kind of like the Zeter boys. Okay, this guy's going to be tall. You know, it's like with Isner. You know, we have Manny Diaz was on our podcast, and, you know, we said to Manny, and John, he takes such great care of his body. I mean, the dog lover, everybody, you know, no, everybody loves Isner. Isner had a great line about Nick Kyrgios. Nick needs to just keep being Nick. I mean, you know, there's been some, you know, the rumors that, well, maybe Jack Sock's not the most popular guy, but he's going to get along with Isner. And, but on our podcast, Manny Diaz, and we've had so many of these now, you know, we know some people that are, they've discovered our podcast and we're flattered by they're starting on this end, watching the current ones, and then they trying to watch two a week and catch up. But I said, what if John Isner had Welby Van Horn's backhand volley? And he said he'd have millions more money, more millions in the bank. And but Matt Clore knows really well how Isner was trained. He's a basketball player. And, you know, I've had junior people that – I've had coaches who taught him in juniors, and now they've listened. And a lot of it, they're getting the cornerstone of the Vic Braden. Again, I think that's been mentioned on our podcast where Dave Secker, coach at NC State, says they just need to change the photos. And that is so true.
Right.
Where people look at our forehand, they even look at our demos and they go, I'm not doing that because they don't get it. But Ryo Pelka would have been he'd be so much better if he was trained to be an all-court player. You know, this serve plus one, come on, throw that away. I mean, it's like hit you don't talk to 12-year-olds like that. You know, he'd be a different 12-year-old because obviously he's a bigger guy, he had a bigger serve, but. And that's what they're trying to do. They toss over their head. They're falling. They're righty falling to the left. The serve's not good. And they've got a, you know, Bud Collins, they got the Western grip. It's so far west, it's Hawaii. It's Hawaiian grip. And they're playing that way. But why don't you wrap it up with one closing comment? We're back.
Well, it's great to see you back. It's great to see you smiling, looking healthy, having your grapes downstairs. So it's welcome back. I missed you. I look forward every morning last week when I would text you in the morning to see how you were feeling.
No, I mean, I wasn't taking
good.
Wasn't
felt
taking
good
wasn't taking
to reply.
I still really haven't been taking phone calls.
I still want to see the I'm still waiting for that selfie that, for you to take. So it's your first picture on your phone.
Yeah, that's
but
not
welcome
gonna,
back.
That's not going to happen. But no, so many people that thank you for your comments and your well wishes and so many people, especially Yvonne, just helping me out.
And, you know, worry he could be replaced here. He was pretty good.
No, for sure. He's better looking too, you know. You know, Juan...
no mistakes on his end.
A Colombian, Juan Sebastian Manrique, he flew in to help out for several days. And you know, he had to eventually fly out. But just because we had it, we don't have a big program. I mean, I've been flattered by people who told us, yeah, you have the biggest program in the United States because if you count the number of coaches we have in these pockets of coaches... You know, it is quite large, but anyway.
Well, welcome back. It's now at, I don't know, maybe 9:30. It's time for you to go to sleep. Try to see if you can get a solid 8 hours in.
Old man, 137's in the books. We'll be back again, and I hope you got some out of it. I think if you hang in there's always a few golden nuggets. I think the coach at Harvard, Andrew Rube, keep your eye on the ball and your nose in the book. That's a podcast worth listening to. Just that one comment, and then be able to, you know, put it on the refrigerator. So your kid, hey, your title's student athlete. So yeah, whether it's just a phrase or a drill, some idea. Hopefully, it's all adding up, and people are getting something out of it. But listeners, thanks. Yvonne, Andres, thanks. Adios, amigos.